Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Vachon. This podcast is a forum for discussions about working with young people, a place for those who are doing interesting, creative, important work to share their passions with an international audience. Many of us do our work and don't have the opportunity to learn what is happening beyond our communities, cities, or countries. Some of us are so busy that we can't find the time to read journals, travel to conferences, or meet with others. I hope that C2Y Podcast can provide some access to those working outside our usual spheres and ways. Today's conversation is the first podcast where someone has approached me to suggest I interview them. I hope this is the first of many such podcasts. If you think that the work you are doing would be valuable to share with others, I encourage you to contact me through the podcast website, c2ypodcast.org, or email me directly at wolfgang@c2y.org. That is WOLFGANG at the letter C, the number 2, the letter Y.org. Today's conversation continues our dialogues about youth in care and youth leaving care. Dr. Tahin Ismail has recently completed an important piece of research looking at the outcomes for children and youth in care and those who has transitioned out of care in Bangladesh. His research challenges some well-established beliefs about youth in care, and I look forward to sharing this revealing work with you. Hello and welcome, Tahin.
Thank you.
Your journey to this work is an interesting one, and like many of us, you did not start out to work with young people. Can you tell me how you came to this field?
Thank you. It is an interesting journey. I was never dreamed, so I'll be working with children. So my father, he wanted to be me to be an army officer. My mom wanted to be a doctor. So finally, I ended up in the university as a forestry student. So because both of the job had prestige and being a practical person, a practical man, so they thought that, but it didn't work out. But when I was in the university, I used to do voluntary work with slum-dwelling people, and I used to support the slum-dwelling education center, the local NGO. They were supported them. So I used to do that. One day, I went to visit a new child education center, and I never went there before. That day I went there and I asked them what they wanted to do. So some of them, they wanted to dance, some of them wanted to draw some pictures, that's fine, because then once it finished the dancing bit, they did it and we enjoyed, and other group of children, they drawn pictures. But one of the girls, she drawn a different kind of picture, and that caught my attention. And that was not very bright, but it was different. And that was different segment. One segment was how was the life is poverty driven. One segment was how her brother died because their parents couldn't take him to the specialist doctor. Then what is the relationship with others, family, these. So all this segment had a different story. So when I asked the girl to tell me the story, she was a bit shy, but once she opened, it was very, very emotional. And I couldn't control, and I had to cry with all this. So once we finish this thing, then I couldn't say goodbye. So on my way back, one boy around 9-10 years old, he was just simply telling me, oh, many people come and go here in the center, but our situation, our fortune never changes. So they come and go, they cry like you, but it doesn't work for us. You people live in the city, earn a lot of money, you don't have much time to think about us. If the main part, if I am your son, I am your daughter, or nephew and niece, what do you do for me or for us? So that was quite emotional, and it struck me. And at that time, I didn't have right answer. Just I was quiet and came back, and it was inside me. And I shared this story many of my friends, many of my families, and but I didn't have any answer. What will be the solution for these slum-dwelling people or for this kind of children? After many years of my working in the development field, environmental field, so one of my friends, he knew I actually like to work with children and the families. I wanted to see the change in the poor people's life. Then he asked me to contact one of the organization's director, because at the time they are looking for researchers about sexual abuse for the children of commercial sex workers. So that organization had a program with different kind of children, like sex worker children, ethnic minorities, rural child, children working in the cigarette industry, children working as a domestic helper, then slum-dwelling children. So many kind of children. So all sort of, so different kind of people, children have different kind of programs. Like for sex worker children, they have two programs, basically. One for those children who are near to the brothel. So they used to give the pre-primary education for the brothel children, those who are, so, and as well as healthcare support. And from there, so we used to bring children to the children's home. This is a children's home for 100 sex worker children, and this is residential, and their objective is to rehabilitate them in the society finally by providing education, healthcare support, skill training, like a parent. So they will be staying there up to their 20s, 21, 22, it doesn't matter. Just if they wanted to stay there, and they will be staying as long as they get good opportunity when they leave there.
What age do they enter into the center?
When we started this program in 1996, at the time, we didn't have any experience. So at the time, we took the children from 7 to 13, 14, 16. But nowadays, over the time, we learn that if the children come in earlier, around 6, 7, and if they can stay longer, that is much better for the children to be grown up. And so usually they don't have that said boundary, but usually 7 to 8, this is the normal age children can go there.
In one of your publications, a beautiful, eloquent publication that really talks about your journey, and the publication is called Becoming a Careful Gardener. Yeah. You talk about initially working with young people and thinking it was really, really important to keep young people away from their parents because of the influence of the sex workers on children. And in that paper, you share your journey in education and your transformation of your thinking away from it's important to keep children away from their parents to it's important to bring parents to spend time with their children. Can you talk a little bit about that shift and why how you made that shift?
Of course, I'll share this, and it is also very interesting. As I told, my background was from forestry and environment, so I didn't have that theoretical knowledge. So once I started working with that organization, after 2 years, I thought that, I don't understand many things, what is happening there. So at the time, I got a scholarship and I did my master's in international child welfare. And at the time, I didn't have any knowledge about what calls attachment, what called resilience, what are the things, this and that. So But before that, when I was in that organization and as a deputy head of the organization, so as sex workers, we always thought that, oh, this is sex worker, because this is also stigma. And many of the mothers actually, they thought that, okay, we'll take these girls when they grown up and put them in the sex industry. That was their understanding. So actually saving that girl, we try not to get involved so much mother in the children's home. So many of the children, we didn't allow them to go to and see their mom. So at that time, there was a lot of dropouts and we didn't know what actually happening. So once I did my master's and when I was there and I learned about the importance of having relationship with mom or parents, at the time and when I went back and as a deputy and I discussed with this and I just changed the rule and I said, okay, mom can come anytime because they don't need to take an appointment beforehand. They can come and if the children are free, they can spend time with them. And it's like a magic. It worked very well and dropout rate has nearly stopped. Children are much calmer, much happier, and also moms are very happier. There was no rumor and other thing.
Did you find that when the mom started visiting, did they still have this intention to bring their children into sex work? And are you seeing the moms, as they establish, continue this relationship, they're bringing their children into sex work when their children become of age?
So this, most of the mom, their attitude has changed, but still there might have a very negligible amount of mother they might think about this. One thing I need to mention here, like other kind of residential home, usually parents, they want send their children to the institution or the residential home. But on the other hand, for sex worker children, we, the NGOs, people, we are much more concerned about the children than mom. Because mom, usually they didn't want to send their children to the institution. But in the brothel environment, brothel situation is very, very bad. They don't have any opportunity for their food, their education, they can sleep, and their rights had been violated in every way. And all the girls, though even for 9, 10, 11, they get involved in the sex profession. Boys, they get involved in the crime or drug addict or human trafficking. So we wanted to rescue these boys and girls from brothel. So at the time, mother didn't have that kind of understanding whether really the organization, the children's home, will work out. So over the period of time, mother's attitude had changed when they saw that, oh, the children are doing very well in every aspect, in education, healthcare, the relationship. They try to understand what does it mean by family outside the brothel, because inside the brothel, they don't have any understanding. What is the relationship have to have with the father? What is the relationship have to have with the brothers and sisters? So I can say some mother still don't have that kind of negative intention, but most of the moms, now they have changed their attitude.
That's wonderful. So you worked a lot with children who came from a sex work background. What else would bring a young person into care in a Bangladesh context besides being a child of a sex worker?
In Bangladesh, basically five kind of residential home. One type is run by the government, and it's earlier the name was orphanage, but now they have changed called children's home, like a SOS, children's village kind of settings. Second type is run by the NGOs. Those children are most disadvantaged, most neglected and vulnerable. And third group of children that is run by the community people and faith-based organization, most of them call orphanages. Fourth group of children, they are in cadet college. They are a bit of like boarding school. And after when they graduate in after 11 or 12th grade, they join normally in army or navies. And fifth group is called coaching center here, like boarding school kind of thing for higher group of children, and those from higher society, they send their children for higher education, like academy school. So there's five group, but I did most of the work with three group of disadvantaged group, like government, NGOs, and the community. The reason the children goes to that institution, for NGOs, what I said, this is they are the most disadvantaged, most risky in terms of their safety and security, because sex worker children, they get involved in all the crime, and girls become involved in the sex profession. And also, they don't have any place to sleep, because mom has a small room, and in the same room, they have their everything, they entertain client and children, they see what is happening, and a lot of mafias inside.
So when you say that those children are the most disadvantaged or neglected, you're saying prior to coming into care, those are the highest risk children?
Yeah, highest risk. Or not only sex worker, the only sometimes the street children, the traffic children, they're supporting. But my research was with the sex worker children. This is one. Second group of children are supported by the government. They say they are orphan, but not necessarily all the children are in the orphan. This is due to poverty, one of the reasons. And as well as many parents send their children for their education, their health care, and they think that, the children will get a better opportunity once they're in the institution, once they finish their education, they will get a good opportunity and will be rehabilitated through government.
So parents who are alive but poor, can't afford schooling for their children, say, okay, well, we'll send these children to an orphanage, we'll say that their parents are dead, and they will get the proper education, and then their life will have more possibilities.
Yes, yeah, you summarized it very well. And third group of children, those who are in faith-based organization or they call orphanages. This is the interesting bit here. Usually, everybody in Bangladesh or other part of the world, they think that children goes to the faith-based organization, they are very poor, but nearly 93% children, they go to the institution, their parents send their institution due to their strong religious belief, not necessarily for their poverty. The poverty, education, healthcare support, all the things are the addition to that. So basically, these three types of institutions supporting different priorities of children's.
And the one run by the community, so I understand NGOs, they want to help disadvantaged people. I understand the government often feels an obligation, and parents say, my parents do die, and some parents say, I can't take after my children. This idea of a community run, we don't have that in Ontario and in North America very much, certainly not in a formal way. What motivates a community to bring in poor children, orphan children, or other children? What would motivate the community?
This is one of the big reason is still Bangladesh is in extended families. So community is a big thing. We have to have community. And as we don't have this welfare state like your part of the world, state supports for everything. But the community in our part is also like supporting each other, helping each other, doing things in a community way. This is one of the big reasons. This is also the culture. And at the same time, this culture actually grew through their either cultural values or religious values. Because most of the people here is Muslim or the Christian or the Hindus, they do it because they wanted to support the children due to their religious understanding, religious feelings, as well as a human being. We need to support, we need to help this needy because this they think that this is our responsibility.
So you and I have a mutual friend, mutual acquaintance, Rowan Ibrahim, who I've interviewed on this on this podcast, and she and I spoke a great deal about the stigma attached to children going into care, and she works in Jordan. And in the Jordanian context, there is, you know, government homes and there's NGO homes, but we don't see that those homes run by community. The immediate family embraces the children, but there's no formalized community embracing of the children. And that's, you know, Jordan also, as you know, is a very, very Muslim community. So what do you think creates that unique opportunity in Bangladesh for the whole community to take it on, and what I understand from your research, reduce the stigma of going into care? What's different in Bangladesh than, say, a Jordanian context?
That's interesting. I also read Rowan's thesis and article as well. So before that, I need to make a bit clear about that in Bangladesh, we don't have any data how many children are in the institution, but by some estimates, it's nearly 6 million.
Nearly 6 million children in care?
Yeah, 146 million people in Bangladesh, the population. So nearly 6 million children is in the institution. This is by some estimates. But it's more than 99% children are supported by that religious community or the community people. Only 10,800 children is supported directly by government, and less than 1,000 by NGOs. So, but the NGOs, those who are most disadvantaged, for sex worker children, they suffer a lot in stigma. Government children, they suffer in stigma as such. But community children, they don't suffer in stigma because they have the connection with the community. They have the connection with the with their existing parents or the relatives, or their kinship care is there. So they don't have that kind of stigma surrounded by them not to have their parents. And another thing is one of these what I said, the religious understanding, the learnings from religion, oh, we need to support, we need to help the needy. In terms of Jordanian context, one of the reasons maybe this is the children are those who are from out of marriage. So still in Bangladesh, because the sex worker children are not accepted well because of religious, cultural issues and stigma there. I think that is one of the big reasons in Jordan as well, because children... identity is a big issues in from Rowan's research. I found that. So this is also a case for the sex worker children here in Bangladesh, because they suffer a lot, because once the children start growing up and start to integrate in the society through their school, through their community, they don't know who is their father. So, and here in Bangladesh, people first they wanted to know who is your father, what is his name, who is your families. So they start the problem. So identity is one of the big issues, and stigma is also a big issue here.
So if, for example, these children of sex workers could be accepted into the community schools, what do you think that the outcome would be different for them as well?
Yes, it's already the outcome already we have started to get it, because when we started this program in 1996, at the time none of the school actually accepted the children, because they thought that, oh, if they accept the children, their community, the children, they will leave, and the parents, they pressure the school, oh, if you take these boys or girls, so we are not going to send our boys or girls in this institution. But interestingly, another religious-based madrasa, they accepted the children. And so then after negotiation of many years, we started a primary school inside the children's home. So we invited children, those who are in the primary school, primary group. So then the children in the children's home and children in the community, they start to understand each other. And the children, those who finish their grade five, then they goes to the community school. So they had accepted it. And now some of the boys and girls in the university, yes, they're suffering, and they usually don't tell the people who are there, where they come from. But it's changing. Government is also taking different steps. By law, nobody have any rights to discriminate. But it's happening. Children are doing great.
That's wonderful. Let's go to some of the outcomes that you found, because in a North American and in a European context, the experiences of young people transitioning out of care, the outcomes are quite poor. So we have a higher rates of homelessness, higher rates of incarceration, higher rates of poverty, higher rates of substance abuse for young people who've been in care. What you found is that those young people who are in the madrasas in particular are not having the same outcomes as those who are going through just the NGO system or the government homes. What are the outcomes that you found with these young people who've gone through the madras system?
Interesting. In my research, I compare and contrast three types of institutions, the children, how they grown up there, and what is their in-care experience, what is their leaving care experience, and what is their after-care experience, and what are the support they're getting in terms of education, healthcare, relationship, and networking, and after-care support. But one of the interesting thing before starting my project, being an social worker and the professionals, I thought, NGO, they will be the best, because we have been supporting them and we are spending millions of pounds. So they will be the best, and that could be the model for others, because many people around the world, they actually visited our children's home. So I thought, that could be a very good model for others. And that was my intention was to prove that. But fortunately or unfortunately, when I started my research and data, that guided me different way. The children in the madrasa, they don't have any good facility for their accommodation. They don't get good food, but their outcome is much better, because one of the big reason, they have very good contact with their families. That religious understanding or spiritual understanding is so strong, and they don't have much activities like NGOs. So in NGOs or government, we wanted to give all kind of skill to the children, like dancing, martial art, singing, whatnot. But on the other hand, the madrasa education or the orphan faith-based organization, they give more focus on education, as well as religious belief that, everything God has decided, what will happen. So that is one of the big thing. So once they left care, society as a whole, they also support once they leave institution, because society, they think that this is their responsibility to rehabilitate the children. At the time, they may not be children as such, but they got some sort of job, and they even get the private tuition for the children. They got job in Bangladesh. They have a lot of mosques. They have in every school you need religious teachers. So in job wise, they get more job. Their education wise, they get more opportunities in as such. So in that respect, if I compare with three types of institution, their outcome is much more bigger. Second reason, their outcome is much bigger than other two. In government institution and NGOs, after a certain period of time, many of the children, especially when they're in adolescent period, the NGOs and government, they just evict the children, expel the children. In some way, the NGOs and government, they don't have that much of tolerance to accept that. So the madrasa children, there is not a single expulsion, anything. So what happened? So that's why you see their children are growing every year. So that's why you can see the a big tangible outcome rather than after supporting 10 years in NGOs or after a big amount of time. And once you expel the children, then you don't see any outcome.
Why are children being expelled from the government homes and the NGO homes?
So this is especially from my own experience and research experience, what I found, that when the children in adolescent period, they do a lot of mistake or the behavior change, but unfortunately, the staff is not qualified enough or talent enough to handle the situation, because that is the age you need to handle with care. Mm-hmm. And so that didn't happen. And at the time, many of the region, because children, they wanted to go out, they wanted to make friends from outside, but government and NGO, they have a lot of restriction, and children get violent. So that is an ultimate aim. They thought that, for the sake of other children, for the sake of safety and security, for the sake of other thing, so we need to expel the children.
Why did the madrasas not expel the children then? My thinking would be that the NGOs with all the trained staff would have the resources and capacities and skills to be able to deal with these normal developmental situations, and that the madrasas would not have the skills because these people are not coming from a trained background, but are coming from a faith-based background. This really challenges a lot of my understanding of the skills of people working with children. What are the madrasas doing that's different?
Yeah, that's interesting. This and same question in my PhD examiner, they asked me what you're asking me. The main reason madrasa, they don't expel any children, that doesn't mean in the madrasa there is no naughty children. That definitely is there. But madrasa staff somehow can manage it, and they thought that, if the children we expel, what will happen? The children will be actually ruin their life in one way. So, and also this is our religious duty to support them in different ways. So they're supporting in that way. And also the moral or religious belief and a strong faith, that also help them to support. And another thing I have to mention here, because madrasa children, they don't feel that much of a strict regime like the NGOs and government children are feeling. Because madrasa children, they can go to their home in every week, or even some of the children, if their parents live near to the madrasa, they can see and meet their mom and dad. Even in every day. So they may not be very crazy in own sense.
And similar to what you found with your work, the children of the sex workers, once that familial relationship was reestablished and was fostered, that the behavioral challenges that the staff were facing decreased dramatically.
Yeah.
So in Ontario, a lot of the original homes, residential facilities were religious-based. And in Canada, for example, we had horrific, horrific crimes against people here in religiously-based residential homes. So we called them residential schools, and there's a long legacy of systemic and individual abuse against people. And at this point in time, there's very few faith-based residential programs in Ontario, or indeed across North America. What your research indicates is that is the most effective program. And I'm wondering, what, if anything, can we learn here in Canada, in North America, in Europe, from your research in a Bangladesh Islamic context?
Yes, so what you mentioned is a religiously nurtured institution has a lot of legacy in Europe and other part of the world. And I wouldn't say here in Bangladesh or other Muslim populated countries, institution, that is not happening. But there is a difference between that part and here. And I wouldn't recommend fully to go in a religious-based institution because things had changed over the, because science and technology and other thing has changed the world. So I would recommend to have some sort of spiritual education, if not in religious education, because everybody's life has to have some sort of destiny. And if they know it in through their religious understanding, religious belief, that helps them to guide. So from this part, I think that could be a good lesson for the developed world. And if you allow me to say, the it's many kind of materialistic kind of society, the families becoming more nuclear. So that will help. And second thing, still in Bangladesh, the family bonding, extended family, is quite strong. And the relationship is very, very important. So you see that in Great Britain or Europe or in America, North American, children goes to the institution. And if you see the background, the parents either drug addict or the broken families, and it's comparatively much more bigger number than our part of the world. So that's why children actually, they don't get that kind of opportunity to bond a strong relationship with their next of kin or the extended families. So usually it doesn't work in many time with staff, because in staff in the children's home, the staff dropout rate is also very high. So all these issues, the spiritual bit or the relationship bit, I think it is, and as well as if at all possible to develop a sense of community ownership for this kind of children, then it will help for these children to feel secure.
In North America, child welfare is seen as the last resort. It is extremely rare that a parent would willingly bring a child into care and say, this is a tremendous opportunity. There's still huge amounts of stigma. And I'm wondering about seeing the community as responsible for children, parents recognizing the advantages of having this child in this supportive structure with this guidance, recognizing the limitations of their own economic parenting, et cetera, and not having the community stigmatize the parents and stigmatize the family. Do you think that that has some positive effect as well, that the families that bring their children to the madrasas, they are not stigmatized, but it's seen as an appropriate and welcoming family developmental choice?
Yes, in one way, that's right. Even you see this in developed world, both parents are busy with their work and they have to go for work, and they send the children to the nursery or other place. So even my next article, I was writing about that, because children actually, they don't get much attention from their parents. They are sending their children to either to the nursery or somewhere else to look after. But in our context, yes, poverty is one of the issue. But at the same time, the community, they take the ownership of this. And only one group of people, those who are in the upper end of the strata, they might think that, only poor children or they goes to the institution. That is not the case, actually. And we didn't have that understanding before my research, because my research is this is the first scientific research in residential childcare here in Bangladesh and even for South Asia. So this is the whole community actually take that as a positive notion. So that helps.
Yes. So where are you going to go with this research now? What are you doing with it?
Now I am doing two things. So first, I am trying to do dissemination of my research findings and different group of people, including policymakers. And second thing, I am developing a proposal, developing a national childcare policy in Bangladesh, because we don't have anything like that. I have been trying to contact with different organizations, because it will take a lot of time to pressure the government to develop such kind of thing. And that will be a big project for 5-10 years, maybe. And a lot of works need to be done, because my research is only in a small group of children. If you consider the 6 million children in the institution, and mine is only very, 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 very little. But on the other hand, I can say, because in Bangladesh is a homogeneous country, so I'll be really wondered if the findings are very different. So these two things I wanted to do to develop national childcare policy at the moment and do more work in this field to let people know and to understand. At the same time, people from the West, those most of the time see residential childcare is a negative choice. I think there is a good learning. Residential childcare not necessarily always negative if you can support the children, because the children, they get a good opportunity to get their friends, because in the family they don't have that much of friends or their brother and sister, because one children or two children will be child will be in the family, so they get lot of opportunity. They develop communication skill, they develop the friendship skill, lot of skill they can get. So residential childcare could be a positive choice for many of the parents.
That really challenges a lot of our notions, our Western North American notions of family. And I think it challenges it in a really provocative and important way that we really need to think about here. How else could people become involved with your future thinking or your process?
We need to do some comparative work from developed and developing world, and we need to learn each other, the findings from each other. So in many ways, we can help each other. So, like expert from your part of the world, they can come here and do some joint work, and we can go. Students from different university and those who are working with youth and childcare, so they can come and see what is happening in first-hand experience. And many international NGOs, they can also get involved with the residential childcare, because unfortunately the huge number of children in the faith-based organization, but none of the NGOs actually supporting them. If they get a bit of support, the outcome could have been done much more tangible.
So the madrasas are not getting any NGO support, and no. What you're suggesting is through your research we can start to see the efficacy of this approach, and why not support these programs rather than just the traditional programs that are supported?
Yeah, that's true. That's why I wrote my one of my chapters, just I criticize a little bit, because an NGO supporting sex worker children and other disadvantaged children, that's right. And I'm not saying that is bad in Christ's perspective. But many of the NGOs, they are not supporting in madrasa because due to their religious affiliation. In the UNCRC, in the child rights perspective, you cannot ignore or discriminate any children due to their religious understanding, religious belief, or the religious teaching. So they have the right to get support from international NGOs, local NGOs, because if they get, and also there is a gap between the NGOs and the religious education or religious institutions, the people who are working there. So there is a lot of ways.
That's an important point. And I really encourage people to develop those international partnerships and research partnerships, I think that the field of child and youth care is really coming into its own, and we have enough, there's enough research being done now that we start to understand what works and what doesn't work, and research such as yours, which challenges us to think beyond what we've learned so far, is crucial. And only by doing those collaborations will we continue to learn from each other.
I wanted to say that, because in the institution that you are recruiting staff, you are not paying them a sufficient amount of money. So this is always the second class or third class citizen kind of mind. So you are not paying them as such. And their social status is not good. So why they will be staying there? So you need to look after the staff, those who are working with this, with the children, so with the sector. So if you can support them, both financially, emotionally, professionally, so then you will get more support from them, as it helps to get better outcome.
And we're seeing that around the world. You know, that the lack of status, the lack of pay, the lack of support, lack of resources is reflected in the quality of staffing in some situations, not all situations, of course, but in some situations. Yeah, and I guess the argument can be made that someone who's coming at it from a faith-based perspective, as many people do in North America as well, there's a passion there, there's a commitment there that sometimes allows someone to work for less pay because of their convictions.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of good thoughts and good comments. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and your research with me.
Thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye.
Okay. Thank you.